Thank you, Mechie and Dan. I'm glad we got a chance to sing along and clap along at the end. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Mary Mullen, a member of the program committee. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. And we welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, your sexual orientation, your gender, or your family structure. And we welcome you also no matter what your age, or your abilities, or your inabilities. Later in the service, we'll invite visitors or guests or returning friends who haven't been here for a while to introduce yourselves and the purposes so that we can get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we offer a wide variety of programs. They're presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, or by a minister, Sandra Ingham, who is in the back row on the left-hand side over there. And today, today our very own Ken Haydock, who I believe is not a member, but he's a longtime friend, will be speaking to us on the subject of, let me find it here, the secular roots of Taoism. I'd like to read the opening words, and Peter will light the chalice. 30 spokes share the wheel's hub. It is the center hole that makes it useful. Shape clay into a vessel. It is a space within that makes it useful. Cut doors and windows for a room. It is the holes that make it useful. Therefore, profit comes from what is there. Usefulness comes from what is not there. Okay, Lao Tzu. Well, I'd like to introduce our speaker, Ken Haydock, who, as I mentioned, has been coming to Prairie for quite a long time. I don't know, several years anyway. He's a longtime friend of Prairie, and he describes himself as an amateur on this topic. Like so many people of this congregation, he searches to find his own pathways that lead to spirituality. And recently, Ken has been casting his net to the Far East. So today he's going to talk about the secular roots of Taoism. And a later service, he'll talk about Buddhism. Please welcome Ken.
Yes, I do start with the disclaimer that I'm an amateur, not an academic in this area. But it's more than recently, I've had occasion over the past 40 years or so, sporadically, to read different translations of the two written works that were the start of Taoism. And over the last maybe 5 or 6 years, I started to do some reading about Buddhism. And I discovered something that came as a surprise to me that I thought was interesting, which is that for the first couple of hundred years after it first surfaced, Taoism was really not yet associated with what you would identify as a religion. Its teachings were adopted eventually and turned into Taoism, the religion that exists to this day. Confusion arises because we use the term Taoism both to refer to the philosophy and to the religion itself. The same thing is true basically with Buddhism, although it took about 400 or 500 years before Buddhism produced its dominant form, Mahayana Buddhism, which is clearly a religion in terms of ritual and many of its beliefs. But its roots also were largely in a secular philosophy. Footnote for Buddhism, you might consider that reincarnation involves the supernatural, but even there, it does, if you assume that Buddhists are talking about reincarnation literally, not all do. That said, when we get to Buddhism, which is part two of this mini-series, that's a relatively easy talk to do, because the Buddhists from the earliest times were creators of numbered lists of ideas, and they spent a great deal of time defining what the items on those lists mean. Trying to describe Taoism, by contrast, is like trying to use words to carefully and accurately describe the three-dimensional shape of a cloud. Before we get to some Taoist concepts, which I want to talk about, and I hope to wrap up with talking briefly about the second most famous passage in the oldest book involving Taoism. Before we get there, though, I think it's important to know that there are certain barriers or impediments that stand between us and the modern age in the West, and understanding what the first couple of Taoist writers had to say. And so I want to sort of set that foundation. Again, when we get to Buddhism, that won't be necessary. So I'm going to do something akin to what a political analyst call a discussion of process rather than policy first. 2,400 years ago, give or take a century, in north central China, a couple of men, contemporaries, one older, one younger, set some thoughts down in writing. And the older of the two is a fellow whose name was Li Er, Li being his surname. The younger was named Chuang Tzu, and in all cases, my Chinese pronunciation is approximate. Li Er wrote a book of 81 chapters, but most of these chapters are about two paragraphs long. And his audience was people in positions of power or authority. That's kind of who he was addressing. And his book has become known as the Tao Te Ching. A Ching is a text that's highly an ancient text that's highly respected. Another one you may have encountered is the Yi Ching. Looks like it's spelled I Ching. Well, the Yi Ching is the ancient important text on the subject of change. Happens to be a book of divination. The Tao Te Ching is an ancient respected text on the subject of Tao, which is the central principle of Taoism. We'll get into that in a bit. The word literally means the pathway, and it's generally translated the way. And De, which is either virtue or power. So the name of the book is The Great Treatise on the Way and Virtue or Power, or the Way and Its Virtue and Power, depending on which translation you feel most comfortable with. Now, the book written by Chuang Tzu is inventively referred to as the Chuang Tzu. And it runs some 33 chapters, and scholars tell us the first seven chapters are the ones that Mr. Chuang personally wrote. The remaining chapters, 8 through 33, also embody his philosophy. We're not sure exactly how much of a hand he had in writing them. And his audience was folks in general, but the principles pretty much the same. And a complete translation into English of the Tao Te Ching can be very short. This is a complete translation, this little book here, okay? In normal text, it runs more like 40, 45 pages. And while the Chuang Tzu fills a sort of a normal size book, and its chapters are more normal size, the first seven chapters, the ones that Chuang Tzu wrote, referred to as the inner chapters, they run about 50 pages. So you'd think that of a rainy afternoon, you could sit down with about 100 pages, read through them, reflect on them, and come away with a clear understanding of what Taoist philosophy is all about. And here's why you'd be wrong. There are a number of impediments that we face in understanding what the Chinese characters that were set down 2,400 years ago, give or take a century, what they mean. Now, first off, we're dealing with a work of works that embody philosophy. These aren't written the way philosophy books that we're used to seeing are. They're not expositions of the philosophy. They're not tutorials in the philosophy. They just adopt the philosophy in what they say. When you read philosophy, you're already faced with trying to read something that requires a certain amount of an understanding of the context, and you're reading it analytically. There's unfamiliar terminology or familiar terms redefined. Well, this wasn't, reading philosophy is not like reading a well-written cookbook. It's not unambiguous. And regrettably, neither of these books are written in that fashion. You have to infer from what is said what is this philosophy that's being expressed. Secondly, we, for the most part, here in the West, don't ordinarily sit down and read something written in classical Chinese. We have to rely on translations. Now, in the case of the Chuangzi and English, there is one book, one translation that seems to have very little competition on the bookshelves. And that is this book. It's a translation by a fellow named Burton Watson, who is a professor at Columbia, and he did this about 50, 60 years ago. If you compare his translation to other people's translations, you find there's some variation, but it's no more different than, say, something you may have encountered in terms of translation, a couple of different versions of the Bible. How it's expressed, how poetically, word choice will vary, but the ideas are pretty much the same. So there's not too much of a problem with respect to translation for Chuangzi. Li Er's work, however, and I keep calling him Li Er, so if anyone's confused, that was the man's name. Lao Tzu was sort of an affectionate and honorary nickname. Konrad Adenauer was Der Alte, right? Siddhartha Gautama is the Buddha, the enlightened one, okay? Well, Lao Tzu means the old philosopher or the old scholar. The characters literally mean old boy, which I think is very British. But Lao Tzu is a title rather than his name. Li Er, or the translations of what he wrote, are numerous. You could probably find on the bookshelves right here in Madison, libraries, bookstores, used bookstores, 2 to 3 dozen different translations. Pause for editorial. In my view, easily half of them are worthless. They are not real translations. They are complete reinterpretations. In what way, Ken? Well, for example, some people want to advance the thesis, perfectly reasonable thesis, that all religions basically teach the same thing. Fine. But it was 2 or 3 centuries before this philosophy became part of a religion. So if you're trying to prove something about religion, you're on the wrong bookshelf. Other folks basically, calling themselves translators, bring an axe to grind. And they want to impose their viewpoint on the text. Not the least of this is occasionally you'll see translations of the Tao Te Ching where the term Tao is translated as God. There's really nothing of the supernatural in or referenced in or important to the Tao Te Ching. Now back at Chuangzi's book, there's a lot of seemingly supernatural stuff because the entire book consists of parables. It's metaphor and allegory, okay? In the case of the Tao Te Ching, not so. But I, for one, have difficulty with the concept that somebody 2,400 years ago in northern China was dealing with, say, this great Semitic war god Yahweh. I just don't think it influenced the text, and there's no reference in the text, with one exception, passing reference, maybe more than one, there's only one that I recall, to a god of Chinese folk religion. But it's not advocacy, it's just a reference. So you have to be careful with the translations, and by way of how to, it's useful, and I know at least one person here other than myself has had occasion to sit down with the Tao Te Ching, and these chapters are very short. Most of them are a couple of paragraphs, and put in front of you three or four different translations by reputable academics who don't have an axe to grind. You recognize the name of the institution they're from, and compare the translation. But there, you're even within that group, you're going to see a wide variety of interpretations. It's possible to select one of the chapters at random, chapter 37, and see two different translations, and it's just impossible to believe that each of the translators started with the same Chinese characters. This is not peculiar to the Tao Te Ching, it's peculiar to the language of classical Chinese. What are the translators up against? Well, apparently classical Chinese, or so the scholars tell us, wasn't just a written language, it was also a style of writing. And it was a style that valued succinctness, brevity. The more terse you could be in expressing your idea, the more elegant. Now, where do we deal with that in our lives? Well, perhaps with poetry. And it's significant. Unitarian Universalist minister said recently, "A good poem needs to be read several times for us to understand its complexity and meaning." Thank you, Sandy. You said that right here a few weeks ago. I think that's a good analogy. I think that brevity tends to bring along its kid sister, ambiguity, and there is a certain amount of ambiguity in all of Chinese, especially classical Chinese, the way it was written. And as if these weren't enough in the way of hurdles and barriers, there's also the fact that the Tao Te Ching, which this is another copy, is written in poetry. There's a reason why these translations vary. There are interpretations of the Tao Te Ching that have taken place in China by Chinese scholars over the last 2,000 years, a couple of them in the first half of the first millennium Common Era are considered the most important. That's a guide to what the meaning is. And it's also, some of this works like a riddle. Once you know the answer, you can see how cleverly worded the question was. And this is how we develop any level of confidence in what it was that Lear had to say so many years ago. Well, what was it these folks were saying? Well, the central principle of Taoism is Tao, and it's hard to define. But basically, it seems to refer to the rules by which the world around us and the universe operate. And it also kind of incorporates the universe itself. Well, what kind of rules? Well, like if I took this piece of wood and let go of it, it would hit the floor, gravity. Rivers tend to flow with force in a given direction. Things like that. Wood has grain that is reliably flowing, follows a certain direction. Well, why is it important to know any of this? Well, the idea is that once you pay attention to and know the way the universe operates around you, or the world around you operates, it's possible to act in accordance with this. Here, again, a block of wood. If you wanted to cut the wood against the grain with a hatchet, it would take a lot more effort than to cut it with the grain. Something as simple as that. But they apply this principle to pretty much all aspects of life. The object is to achieve what is called wu wei, which is literally no action. But in context, it tends to mean sort of the least amount of effort necessary to accomplish the job, okay? And not in a bad way. The Taoists also have their own view of yin and yang. And for the Taoist, it's not two different but complementary things. It's two aspects of one thing. What does that mean, Ken? Well, imagine, if you will, that everything is in pitch darkness all the time. There's no such thing as light. The term dark wouldn't be particularly useful because everything would be equally dark. It doesn't differentiate, it doesn't express a difference or a distinction that's important in such a world. And the term light would have no meaning because it doesn't exist. We live in a world where there is dark and light, and the Taoists say, well, they exist in relation to one another. Lots of things exist in relation to one another and help to define one another. My handy piece of wood has a top and a bottom. These two principles are so intertwined that they are inseparable. Let's say we cut some piece off the top of the wood, threw it away. What will we have? Well, we have a shorter piece of wood, but it would still have a top and a bottom. Good and evil are also related to one another. Fortunate and unfortunate are related to one another. And these principles run through Taoist thinking. Let's consider a couple of Taoist stories to put these things into some context. These just are a couple of favorites of mine. A teacher and a student are taking a walk down a road, and they pass a hillside. And on that hillside is one lone, very short, very twisted tree. And the teacher continues on his way, and the student, walking a few respectful paces behind him, notices the tree, stops, thinks about it, and starts to laugh. Teacher hears this, turns around, goes back to the student, and asks, what's so funny? Student says, will you look at that tree? That is a pathetic tree. It is short, it is twisted, it is ugly. Nowhere in that tree is there wood that from which you could make a board that is long and straight and sturdy and straight-grained, useful for making a house or furniture or a boat. I find that funny. I'm laughing at that tree. Now, at this point, the teacher approaches the student and administers the functional ancient Chinese equivalent of a slap upside the head. What else do you see on that hillside? Well, that's it, just the tree. Ah, says the teacher, 40 years ago on this hillside was a woods, and almost all the trees grew tall and straight and big, and they all produced many boards that were straight and straight-grained and suitable for making houses and furniture and boats. And because they had those traits, they are all gone. Because this tree had its traits, it's still alive. It's still here. Show respect for that tree. Now, in the opening words, there was a passage from the Tao Te Ching, and it mentions, among other things, windows. Consider a window, not these. These have glass in them. We're talking about old-fashioned windows 2,400 years ago, give or take. It's a hole in a wall. Maybe it's octagonal, very Chinese, round. Maybe it's rectangular. What is the window? Well, it's this nice wood framing around the edges, hard, tangible, visible. and then there's the part inside the frame. The Taoists ask, what makes the window useful? And the answer isn't the yang, the hard, visible wood that frames the window. It's the empty part. That's what lets the smoke and stale air out of the room. That's what lets the fresh air and the sunlight into the room. That's what makes it useful. Yin and yang, little pro-yin bias there. Here's another story that I like. There's a fellow who's a very keen observer of just what goes on around him. When we get to Buddhism, that's considered a really good thing, but he's a real keen observer of what's going on around him. And he's in a marketplace, and he walks through the marketplace, and he passes the corner where the butchers have their stalls. And they're the butchers doing their thing. They're hawking their wares, chatting with customers, cutting up meat, so on and so forth. And there's also something else that he notices that they're doing. They're constantly sharpening their knives. All but one observer goes over to the butcher and says, hey, everybody else here, you know, they're in your same trade, and they're always sharpening their knives. I never see you sharpening your knife. Why is that? Butcher holds up his knife with pride. My knife never grows dull. Really? Says the observer. How can that be? Oh, it's really simple. I always cut alongside the bone to remove the meat, and I'll cut through meat, and I'll occasionally cut through a joint, but I never use my knife to cut through bone, and so it never gets dull. Do you see the flow business about the direction that the knife took? And do you see the yin and yang aspects of this? We don't cut through the hard bone, we go through the... If you wanted to cross a river to get from right here to directly the other side, you wouldn't go downstream and try to paddle up against the current. If anything, you'd go upstream and you'd put in enough effort to get across the river and let the river carry you down to the point opposite. Again, this is the sort of concept that the Taoists are constantly talking about. Now, the Tao Te Ching begins in an interesting way. And the opening words are, I think, the second most famous passage in the Tao Te Ching. The most famous, as an aside, comes later. And it uses the word Li, but not as in Li Er, the surname of the author. Li was also a unit of measure, unit of distance. And it says, and I'm taking this in literal terms from the scholars, a journey of 1,000 li starts under your feet. We kind of know this as a journey of 1,000 miles, starts with a single step. This is where it came from. The second most famous passage are the opening words. The way, the Tao, or the way that can be expressed is not the eternal way. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. What the heck does that mean? Here are a couple of my own stabs at trying to explain what Li Er may have been trying to tell us. Imagine, if you will, two rooms, and you're in one room, and in the next room, at no expense to you, someone has prepared your favorite meal. In my case, it would be a coin flip between a really good Thanksgiving dinner or boiled lobster. But this is your favorite meal, and now you have a choice. You can enter the second room and eat your favorite meal. Or you can select a friend and have your friend go into the room and he or she can eat your favorite meal and come back and describe it to you. You see what I'm getting at here? Here's another one. 100 years ago, in Belgium, there was a painter named René Magritte. And if you're familiar with Magritte, you're probably most familiar with an image that he used sometimes once in a painting, sometimes multiple times. And it was always this guy who was dressed all in black, and he had a black overcoat and black shoes and black gloves and a black bowler hat. And then right in front of his face and obscuring it was a large green apple. That painter. Another one of his themes was, and he painted this multiple times, he'd paint on the canvas or the wood the image of a pipe, the kind that you put tobacco in, light up, smoke. And underneath the image, he would paint a sentence in French. Ceci n'est pas une pipe. This is not a pipe. And the first time you see it, you look at the image, that's a pipe. Look at the sentence, this is not a pipe. You look at the image, nope, that's a pipe. Well, academics in the field of art point out, no, actually, Magritte got it right. That's not a pipe. That's an image of a pipe. It's two-dimensional. You cannot pick it up. You cannot put tobacco in it. God forbid you should try to light it. Smoke it. Ceci n'est pas une pipe. This is not a pipe. I think this, again, is in line with what Lao Tzu, Li'er, was trying to tell us. The Taoists believe that in order to understand the rules of the universe and how the universe operates, this is inductive. Can't be conveyed to you in words. The Tao that can be expressed in words is not the eternal Tao. The name is not the eternal name. This is basically what I wanted to share. And as I say, when we get to Buddhism, that's going to be a lot easier. what they're saying is a lot of things that we ordinarily think of as being opposites and separate are actually related. There was the wonderful story which made its way from Taoism into Zen. I'll sacrifice a punchline. Taoism grew up in China, roughly the north of China. And when Buddhism reached China from India, the people who were the Taoists heard Buddhism about Buddhism, and they didn't see any particular conflict between the two. There's some minor ones. And they kind of adopted this, and they formed a form of Buddhism called Chan Buddhism, which said it's not studying, it's not chanting, it's meditation. That's the core. And so Chan means meditate or something along that, Chan Buddhism. Chan Buddhism eventually found its way to Japan, kind of died out in China. But when it got to Japan, it got a new name, Zen Buddhism. So if some of these concepts sound a little familiar, there's a good reason for it, okay? But I think what they're trying to do is get people to not think that there was a tale. I started to say that that in fact Sandy read to the kids a few weeks back about the farmer who suddenly a horse showed up on his property and all his neighbors say, "Oh, this is a great thing," and the farmer said, "Well, maybe," and then the horse ran away and oh, all the time and effort you put in the horse you couldn't be putting into the farm. That's awful. And well, maybe. Nothing is absolutely good or bad. Good and bad are inextricably interrelated, which is not to say that some things aren't good, but good exists together with and in contrast to bad. You can't have one without the other. That's what he's saying, as I understand it. Well, I think that Li'er, who was himself, if he existed, and most scholars believe he did, but not all agree. Chuangzi, we're certain he existed. Li'er was actually a government official, and a lot of what he writes in the Tao Te Ching is about how you will be more effective, if you do the least. It's getting the people to do what is necessary for them. Don't worry about taking credit for it. That's also a wu-wei. It's a form of active passivity, is, you know, hard to describe. That would be, so I think that's the easier illustration. In Chuang-Tzu's case, I just think that you'll be a lot happier if you happen to be a butcher, if you don't constantly try to cut through the bone, you know, with your knife. And just the general principle, if you need to cut wood, think, cut with the grain, it's gonna be so much easier. Look not to fight at cross purposes with the world, or to take stewardship of it and dominate the world. Look at the world as it is and try to act in accordance with it. And again, these weren't written as philosophical treatises. One was written as a bunch of poems directed to people in positions of authority, and the other is a bunch of fables intended to embody and convey the philosophy. No. What Li Er was saying, yes, is directed to leaders, but Chuang-Tzu takes the same principles and seems to be speaking to all of us. And you know, if you're a butcher, if you're a a woodsman, you know, knowing these things is still helpful. And just, you know, time doesn't permit all the possible examples that even they raise. Okay, well, let me tell you another story. And I wasn't sure whether we could fit this in, but this is a story from my own life. And it occurred many years before I ever knew that there was a Tao Te Ching. I was introduced to Tao Te Ching when a friend of mine was reading it, and I said, "Why do you want to read that?" And he said, "Oh, Ken, try it. It's interesting." That was about 40 years ago. I was about 13 or 14, and I was at a beach, and on the south side of Long Island, and I was riding waves in. If you catch the wave just right, it sweeps you into shore. And I had been doing that for a while, and I had pretty much finished, and I decided to head back into shore. And as I was heading in, I noticed that the undertow was really fierce, didn't think anything of it. And then I noticed all the people at the beach were looking out past me, and I turned around, and there was the largest wave I had ever seen. It was one of these things where lots of little waves, you know, come in, and then occasionally all the waves come in at the same time. And I'm looking at this thing, and you know, it felt like an apartment house, but it was probably 20 or 30 feet, and it was just enormous. And I knew enough that I didn't have enough strength and time to run against the undertow back to the beach, but I also wasn't close enough to the face of this wave, which was already, you know, almost vertical, to dive into the face of it the way you can and then just come through it and let it go past you. And I had maybe 2 seconds before it was gonna hit. And I figured, what the heck, and I just went in the direction of the wave. And I had barely a chance to take a deep breath, not a very good one. And so now I'm under the water and I'm being swirled around every which way. And within maybe half a second, I thought, I should swim for the surface. Wait, which way is the surface? There were a lot of very bad options if I decided to swim. So I just relaxed. It was absolutely spontaneous. I just relaxed. And at the point when the second realization that if I'm not careful, I'm just going to take a deep breath right now came about, I felt sand scraping against the front of my body, and I realized, oh good, I'm in water maybe about, you know, a foot high now. This is good. Got up. Had I struggled, this program could have been very different. I happened not to, and so I was kind of primed for the philosophy of whatever the forces are, work with them rather than against them. It's probably going to work out better that way. Well, let me begin with borrowing from Buddhism, the words that all Buddhist tales begin with, as a show of humility. Thus have I heard. Okay. The dominant philosophy, certainly among the people of Li Er's variety, if Li Er existed, and again, most scholars apparently think he did, he had passed through very, very, very rigorous exams to become part of the state government. And it had something to do with the records department. And the dominant thinking in those days hadn't quite yet crystallized into Confucianism. Confucius basically documented it and added to it. But it was very formal, very ritualistic, very social stratification, different roles for people at different levels of society, men, women, so on and so forth. And he didn't like that. And so, in part, this is a reaction to the formalism and you're part of this whole and you better do as we tell you and perform these rituals and show respect to the right people, society that he lived in. Confucianism also was basically, it's almost a political philosophy and not drawn, it doesn't draw particularly on the supernatural. And so that's the context. There are so many, just looking at maps of China at various points in time, the boundaries just were flowing every which way, and there were, states amalgamated and separated and so forth. I think he was living in a time of relative calm, at least in his part of the world. But he just didn't like the formality of the society he was in, is what I gather from what I've read. It's not a very difficult, the concepts aren't that difficult. They aren't laid out for you neatly, but it seemed to resonate with, initially the people who were educated, could read. And many of the fables are, the Chuangzi is just a bunch of parables and fables. Many of them are quite fascinating and memorable, and I think it may have caught on for that reason. It wasn't exactly a society where you were competing against, one dominant organization that wanted you to believe a certain way, other than just the way society was organized. One of my favorite copies of Tao Te Ching is this one, which does something remarkable. I mean, we're familiar with seeing a concordance to the Bible or to Shakespeare. This takes the entire Tao Te Ching, Chinese character by Chinese character, in the order that it appears from, and there are a few variations depending on which manuscripts you start with, and for each character, it lists all the possible meanings. And while I certainly think that it's a perfectly wonderful literary or poetic exercise to read what different people had to say, and I share your joy in the course of figuring out which translations I thought were more in keeping with one another, there seemed to be some consensus about. I encountered some others that were just amazingly bad. One of my favorites was a fellow who was the translator and tells you up front, I know no Chinese. I have read 5 translations, and now I'm going to tell you what the original author had to say. I mean, it can get that bad. But in terms of beauty or provoking thought, absolutely. I don't contest that. But from a sort of an academic standpoint, even in classical Chinese, words have meaning. Thank you.
I'd like to read the closing words. Before creation, a presence existed. self-contained, complete, formless, voiceless, mateless, changeless, which yet pervaded itself with unending motherhood. Though there can be no name for it, I have called it the way of life. Perhaps I should have called it the fullness of life, since fullness implies widening into space, implies still wider, further widening, implies widening until the circle is whole. So thank you all for coming. Please extend the hand of friendship to those around you. Join us for coffee and conversation. Thank you.